Hello, Bill.
Happy 2025, Matt.
Wow, I'm still writing 1987 on my checks. Where'd the time go, Bill?
I take it you are trying your best to enter a mind palace where Ronald Reagan is your president forevermore.
Yeah, I'm like Liz Lemon's brother on 30 Rock who went skiing and still thinks it's the 80s. And Jack Donaghy was like, it must be great there. You know?
Yeah, it's funny you mention that because I literally have spent most of my post-election time watching 30 Rock. Because what I want to relive the Obama years. I want to be there. And that is the greatest cultural artifact from the Obama years.
It is, especially when Jenna Maroney says that we need to capture and kill Obama. I think she meant Osama, right?
Right, right.
No, what a good show. And I still watch it to this day. So,
All right. Have you been? you've been persevering in this period.
Yeah, getting by. So for Bill, I've been getting inundated with people saying, when are you guys going to tape? What happened to the DMZ? And I think after the November elections, you and I both felt like we should do some soul searching. But this is sort of like getting the band back together for one more, hopefully not one last, you know, one last caper, one last bank robbery.
Best friends gang.
Yeah, it's been good. It's been good. Spent some time with the family. Still trying to figure out what the hell's going on in politics. Just got back from a trip to New York. Going to Palm Beach. Not to meet with President Trump. Don't worry. But Bill, what have you been up to?
I mean, I'm trying to figure it all out myself. Look, I have not watched any cable news since the election. You know, I've just completely just changed my media diet. I generally wasn't a watcher. I tend to listen, you know, through the audio stream. And that would kind of be in the background for a lot of the day. And, you know, partly for, you know, perverse entertainment, partly it's idea generation for things to write about. And I don't know if you recall, Matt, when in the first Trump presidency, I made a commitment to not watch him live, to not have him be kind of part of my day and not reward him with my eyeballs. But I still, you know, consumed cable news. And now I just kind of want to take it a step farther. And I just don't want it as part of my life. But I still have a job to do. I still have to write about stuff.
That's the occupational hazard.
Right.
You can't, you know, if you were a mechanic, you could, you know, bid all this ado and just go, you know, cut the cord, you know, you could go off the grid with politics, but we can't do that with our job.
Right. So I'm still kind of, you know, struggling to decide what is my purpose in this period? What do I have to bring to the table? Because my general attitude about writing about Trump has generally been, what's there to say about he's doing a crazy thing today? It's not that interesting. It's pretty obvious. And there's not much to add to it. Not that I never write about Trump. I have. But it's usually when I think I have something to say that hasn't been said before. So I'm still kind of in a state of professional limbo, wondering what it is I should be doing for the next 4 years.
I feel your pain. The best thing that happened to me was getting laid off from the Daily Beast, you know, taking a buyout. Because when I was there, number one, I was writing three columns a week. Number two, you know, everything I wrote, it was all stuff I believed in, but I might pitch them, you know, three or four ideas. Like I'd like to write about the Bob Dylan movie I just saw. Well, guess what? They got an entertainment department for that. So they, you know, they wanted me to write Trump. And so I wrote a lot of columns that could be summed up like this. Did you see the latest thing that Trump did? Let me tell you how bad Trump is. Let me tell you how bad and I believed in all of it. I mean, don't get me wrong, but given my druthers, I probably wouldn't have written so many columns that could be summed up. Let me tell you about the horrible thing Trump just did.
Well, our positions are reversed.
Writing one. I'm only writing one column a week.
Mm-hmm.
And for The Hill, and they're very accommodating to my pitches. So it's been easier for me to like find a way to kind of keep doing stuff without going crazy as I might have if I'd been in that same rut.
Right. So our positions are reversed because when Trump was first president, I was laid off from my job at the Campaign for America's Future, which got taken over by a place called People's Action. And those folks did not really care for my brand of commentary, so they let me go. And so I was strictly freelance pretty much the entirety of the Trump presidency. As you know, a lot of it was running for Politico, and that was not even a weekly gig. It was kind of more like a monthly gig. And so I could pick my spots a little more and not be as all consumed by Trump. And now I'm with the Washington Monthly, and I am writing, you know, 2-3 times a week. And, you know, they're not necessarily, it's not a daily beast. There isn't that same kind of pressure, you know, for news of the day stuff, but I still have to write something multiple times a week. And
Trump makes sure that Trump is the big story pretty much every day.
Right. Yeah. But there's always other angles. There's what happens to the Democrats. What other ideas should we be talking about when things are being ignored? And so I'm not saying I can't find other angles, but and I don't want to make this entire show about, you know, help Bill Scherer figure out his career, but just where my mind has been.
I listen to that. Come on. People love Bill Scherer.
But where my mind has been the past several weeks is, hey, what do I have to bring to this period?
Yeah,
maybe it's more history. Maybe it's more where Democrats go from here. But I haven't quite figured it out.
Well, I'm looking forward to you figuring it out, and I'm looking forward to the process. And you bring a lot to the table, and we'll figure out what we're going to do, how this is going to work out. Bill, I mentioned, you know, normally in a normal show, they jump straight to they give the people what they want, the politics up front, and then they end by talking about pop culture. We do it the opposite. And I mentioned I saw the new Bob Dylan movie, A Complete Unknown. I just saw it a couple days ago with the fam. And I thought of you because Pete Seeger plays the banjo. And there's a lot of Pete Seeger. It's Ed Norton in the movie. And I'm wondering, have you seen the film yet?
I haven't seen it yet. I'm not like a massive, some people are just like super hardcore Bob Dylan fans, which I am not. Not anti Bob Dylan, but I couldn't, you know, go deep into the catalog and you know quote a bunch of lyrics or anything. The previews are interesting, and I'm sort of curious. And the reviews have obviously been, I mean, there's been a lot of rock star biopics, which looked at it. I don't think I've really seen any of them, but the previews, they make them look kind of cookie cutter, and the reviews tend to be kind of middling. And this one is clearly different, where people are far more impressed with it. But I also kind of feel what I see in a movie theater is far, far less these days. And do I need to spend the money to see this kind of film on a big screen?
Yeah.
Like the last one I saw was The Fall Guy, which wasn't something that did very well, but I was actually pretty happy to see a summer blockbuster on a big screen. Like that's meant to be on a big screen. I could probably watch a biopic on a small screen, right?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. No, we just went because it was like New Year's Day and we wanted something to do with the kids and yada, yada, yada. No, you could enjoy this on a nice TV at home thoroughly. You don't need the big screen, but I did like it a lot. And I think as these, is it biopic or biopic? It's unclear, but whatever it is, it's one of the, I've seen a lot of them. And
did you go in as a person with a huge reservoir of Bob Dylan knowledge?
No, I mean, I know I'd interviewed this guy named Jonathan Taplin, who's a fascinating guy. And among his many, many things he's done in his life is he was the tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band. And so he's actually been on my podcast before, and we talked about Dylan going electric at the folk festival. And, you know, he told, so I was familiar with the story. I like some of Dylan's stuff. I'm by no means a completist. But it's interesting, Bill, because I found, you know, the title, A Complete Unknown, to be like a triple entendre, right? So it's obviously a line from like a Rolling Stone.
Mm-hmm.
The movie's also about, it starts off with Dylan being a nobody and kind of becoming famous. So he's a complete unknown. But it just occurred to me recently that it's also, Bob Dylan was really an enigma. He, even after watching the movie, he's still a complete unknown. You never feel like you really know where he came from. I mean, he's from Minnesota and all that, but really where his genius came from and all of that. And yet it was a really good movie. And the music obviously is awesome. I think Timothy Chalamet and Ed Norton and whoever played Joan Baez was amazing too. So the music's great. I do recommend it, but you're right, Bill. You could watch it at home, I think, and get as much out of it.
Have you seen this article that's in N Plus One magazine about Netflix called Casual Viewing?
I have not.
You would be interested in it. That might be, I bet the reporter you'd probably enjoy having a conversation with on your show. Because it's about the Netflix business model and how it is ruining the movie business and the TV business. So like this Bob Dylan movie is sort of a classic highbrow movie marketed in a traditional way to try to appeal to an erudite cinema goer, older demographic with being Bob Dylan and all.
Oh yeah. No, average age, probably 65.
Right.
At the theater. A lot of people, but pushing 65 at least.
And so the Netflix model is not to attract eyeballs to a small set of prestige movies or shows. It's to get subscriptions. That's where the money comes from. And so the amount of people that watch any individual TV show or movie is largely irrelevant to the revenue stream. And what that has led to is a kind of flattening, a kind of middling set of formulaic product with a lot of familiar celebrities. Because if you're watching it, you're probably watching it in a casual way, in the background. I mean, I've been rewatching Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt while I walk my dog. So I'm not even looking at the screen, and sometimes I might even be playing New York Times Spelling Bee while I'm listening to it. I'm not super focused on it.
This accounts for the uptick, I think, in civilians being hit by car, or you know, pedestrians being hit by cars.
Sure. You might do it while you're folding laundry or making dinner or raking leaves or what have you. It's not demanding your full attention the way it is when you go to a movie theater, and so that influences the kind of product you're expecting the studios to produce. And so there are a lot of things on Netflix that have familiar faces, but are not considered in any way, you know, impressive material. And there was a New York Times article several months back about mid TV and saying that mid TV is actually, it's not terrible. It's not the worst. It's pretty good, but it is sort of formulaic and comfortable and predictable. It's just making me think a lot, not just about pop culture, but also about our work. If we're all just kind of hooked on content that is designed to comfort, pass the time, mildly distract, multitask with, what does that mean for trying to produce content, whether it's the written word or video, that's designed to be more substantive? And so I'm curious to see how this Complete Unknown picture is going to do. Because it is sort of cutting against that grain, it seems, and into something that's supposed to be more demanding more of your attention.
I like stuff that's thought provoking, and I watch things with my kids, my family, and I like to then talk about it. And so this Dylan, you know, biopic certainly did that. You know,
so the kids saw it with you.
They did. They both saw
it. What did they think?
Beckett insists that the Bob Marley bio is superior. He loves Bob Marley, that was superior.
You're raising such hippies, Matt.
Burke liked it, and he said, I think his big takeaway was that it made him appreciate folk music more than he ever did before. By the way, I've been trying to, this inspired me to pick up the acoustic, and I've been trying to do some of that Travis picking, which is not my normal style. And I think I'm getting it. It's, you know, from the banjo, but it's, you're retraining your brain to, you know, you got the thumb going and so.
Now, do you use finger picks when you do it on the guitar?
No, I'm just using my my fingers. And I'm using.
I wonder if the finger picks would help. I don't know about finger picking on a guitar. I mean, but you use, you know, metal picks for the banjo. I mean, it just makes a world of difference when you're picking.
No, some acoustic players do use those in the thumb too, but I'm not. So, and I don't think Dylan did either. Joan Baez probably did, but some of that stuff was impressive. And so I listened to one of my resolutions after Trump won. Was to try to figure out what the hell's going on. So I've been listening to a lot of Joe Rogan and Timothy Chalamet, who plays Bob Dylan. He also plays like Harry Potter, and he's in the movie Dune. He was on Theo Von's podcast a couple weeks ago, and I listened to that, and that was very interesting.
So I have interest in delving into this culture. I'm more wanting to run screaming the other way. I mean, I've dabbled in. I've tried to watch a Joe Rogan show. Like I can't get through a 3-hour thing. I don't find it that interesting. Beyond the fact that I find his politics, you know, disturbing. But do you feel like one? You find it actually an enjoyable thing, you know, regardless of the politics. You actually like how he approaches the medium, and do you find yourself having finding value and getting a better understanding of this, you know, this mantleverse.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the one thing that people, sort of media elites, probably don't grasp is that these shows are not political by and large. And I think that's, in a way, that's why they're so influential when it comes to politics, is because people listen to them. They listen to them day in and day out. And you know, radio has an intimacy that I think TV doesn't have. And I think podcasting can have that same intimacy. And when you listen to people day in and day out, you know, three, four podcasts a week, you feel like you know them, and they're not really, and then they're being very vulnerable. I mean, people like Theo Von specifically, he's like a comedian. He doesn't claim to be a political genius. He recently had Bernie on too. So it's sort of bipartisan. And I have to say that the Timothy Chalamet interview was really great, especially having seen the movie. I enjoyed that conversation. And so I think it's making me understand, if nothing else, why they have the impact that they have.
So forgive me if I'm taking you off subject, but I just got the notification that Mike Johnson won the speaker vote.
Oh,
after losing on the first ballot.
I wonder what he had to promise to get that.
I don't know offhand. I can try to tease it out while we chat here.
Well, there were rumors that Chip Roy from Texas wanted to get a certain
position. He wanted the rules committee slot. But he wasn't the holdout. The holdouts were Massey and Ralph Norman and Self. Is it Kevin Self? So Norman and Self flipped. So that's and so I don't know.
Massey didn't flip, which is good, because he said that you could torture him, you could put bamboo under his fingernails, and he still wouldn't vote for Mike Johnson. So he's a man of his word.
There you go.
He was wearing Massey was wearing an Adam Smith necktie today, Bill, which is a famous necktie in the conservative movement. I have one.
You're still not seeing any evidence of what the deal was, but perhaps we just need to wait a little.
Well, we
more
may
time.
Never know. I mean, I don't think we ever really knew all the details behind the Kevin McCarthy deal, right? That he cut with the Freedom Caucus folks. So,
well, people said things. There were various interpretations of what was offered that were roughly the same, but with some slight variations as things progressed. But I am somewhat reluctant to try to divine great meaning from these things. I don't really believe that the Trump presidency is going to be contingent on what Congress does. I think it's going to be more about what Trump does in brazen assertions of executive power. But do you think there is anything important in how tenuous this Republican House majority clearly is?
So two things. One, I think this, I think the Republican conference is a microcosm of a MAGA movement that itself is full of internal contradictions, right? So Elon Musk is not elected to Congress, and neither is Laura Loomer, but they are at loggerheads. And so I think that there are divisions. And so this is maybe part and parcel of that. I also do think, Bill, I think you're generally right that Trump's success and his sort of existence is not largely defined by passing legislation. But I do think to have a successful administration, he will have to pass a few big things.
Well, successful also, to who?
To anybody. To his base, even. To his base, even. I don't think you're right. I think you're right. I don't think it defines him, and I don't think it's his biggest selling point. But I think he's got to do something legislatively. And I also think that he has to raise the debt limit and he has to keep the government running. And I'm just not sure they can do that. Because I mean, if Mike Johnson barely could get elected speaker, then in a couple months, 2 or 3 months, when there's going to be a big vote on, you know, keeping the government open or raising the debt limit or whatever it is, I just don't know if he's going to be able to pull that off. Is he going to?
Well, the two things are different. I mean, you know, debt limit and government keeping open are of different magnitude.
True. I don't think, and I would say, I don't know he can do either.
I mean,
without Democrats,
Trump and if clearly does care about the debt limit in a way that perhaps was not evident to people before. He knows that if you breach the debt limit, you will have a global economic calamity and it will be his party's fault. And so he tried to get it taken off the table before he got there, and he was not strong enough to get his party to agree. So clearly there is, however big the faction is, some faction that wants to use the debt limit to extract some kind of concession on, presumably on spending. Now, whether they, how much they mean that, I don't know. But clearly Trump is worried about it. He vocally expressed his worry about it. He knows, and I wrote about this, I think it is a tacit admission that he knows he's effectively a lame duck on day one. We talk about him as being this cultish leader that he can snap his fingers, make everybody come to. That's true to a point. But when your majorities are this thin, it may not, there are limitations on that power. Like if the government doesn't stay open for a period of time after, I think March is when the next pinch point is there, I don't think he really cares. I don't think he is going to fret if, you know, people can't go to the park that day, or if government employees don't get their paychecks right away, if at all. So that to me is probably less of a concern to him. But do we have, I mean, as it stands, you know, it's like a two vote margin in the House. I guess that might change as a couple of vacancies get filled. But do you have a faction of, you know, five or so Republicans who are literally willing to blow up the debt ceiling and face the consequences if they don't get some kind of budget cut, which in all honest, you know, practically probably is not mathematically feasible. That to me is a big unknown here, which I'm sure probably does terrify Trump.
We've had this discussion many a time, and whether the cut they want to make is like, it may be that I'll put it to you this way. I am all for reining in the debt and the deficit, but the time to do that is not the debt ceiling time. The debt ceiling is like when you pay the bills that you've already spent,
right?
Effectively, right?
Now, so now they're going to do a budget reconciliation bill right out of the gate. And we have this whole, you know, Doge commission. It's not a department, even though they want to call it a department. It's literally, it's a blue ribbon commission, like many people in Washington have done before. You know, in that respect, nothing new here. But they're talking this huge game of massive cuts, which would, if the numbers are talking about, would require massive Social Security and Medicare cuts, which we know they're not going to do. And so when that rubber hits the road with this budget reconciliation bill and the number, the past is that Republicans don't really care about the budget cuts when they're in charge. It's a weapon that they use when Democrats are in charge. So the unknown here, is there a small faction that actually believes what they say about budget cuts and is prepared to go over these cliffs to prove the point? And so the budget reconciliation bill is kind of the first. If you're going to do it, here's your shot. You can do it on a party line vote. No filibuster. You have the numbers. Prove it.
I think it's going to be interesting to watch. I think it is fraught with danger that this could be ugly. And I think, you know, and I think there's you know, from a political, we'll put aside the catastrophic concerns and the hand wringing and all of that. But just from a political standpoint, I mean, you know, there are different scenarios, but there's a scenario where this administration does not go well. Trump raises tariffs, he cuts taxes, inflation goes up even higher than it is. You know, these brinkmanship over the debt ceiling and then the possible fallout or ramifications of that. I mean, there's ways that this goes bad, and that the all the people, you know, everyone who thought Trump was, wow, this guy's amazing, he's magic, he can't lose. It may not end well.
This is why I don't think that Democrats need the kind of deep soul searching that perhaps they've certainly done after past losses. They went in some very deep soul searching after Reagan in the 80s. I mean, go back and watch those State of the Union responses from the first term of the 80s. They are bonkers, because it just shows like how wildly bereft and rudderless the party was at that point. Obviously, after George W. Bush won re-election, Democrats were reeling pretty bad. You know, again, Bush won the first time kind of on a fluke. They felt it was stolen. I would say it was stolen. And a sense that they didn't need to change much to kind of get back. And then when they lost, you know, clearly in 2004, there was this, where do we go from here? We think the country is not what we thought it was. What do we do? And, you know, this defeat in one sense is, I can't believe we lost this guy twice. We don't really have a finger on the pulse of the country. We need to do a whole, you know, brand overhaul. Yeah,
we need to start listening to Joe Rogan to figure right, out what the hell right. is going on.
But the flip argument is, he still can't crack 50%. He benefited from frustration about inflation, which was an atypical circumstance. It's not something endemic to Democratic Party policies that they always bring about inflation. It was a byproduct of the pandemic, which is behind us now. Trump has a very tenuous coalition, very reliant on cult of personality, not so much on a set of policies everybody agrees upon. And the things that he's prepared to do seem to violate the expectation of what he's going to produce, which is lower. If he's raising tariffs when he's promised lower prices, that is the opposite of what the mandate is. So you can very easily say, sit back and watch the collapse, and Democrats will do just fine 2 to 4 years from now.
Or you could just say, as long as Trump leaves, it's also problem solved. I'm really becoming even more of a subscriber to this sort of great man theory of politics, which is to say, it just seems like in the modern era, you got to be a rock star to win. Reagan was obviously a movie star. He had the Riz. George H.W. Bush didn't have it, maybe a little more than Dukakis, but he didn't have it, so he's a one-termer. Bill Clinton's obviously got the swagger, the charisma, the charm. W had it in a certain sense. Obama in a very different way, but he's the biggest superstar in the world. Donald Trump has it. And so I just think a lot of it, we talk about get out the vote and door to door and fundraising and ads and polls and all that. But I think just a lot of this is there are certain people you're just not going to beat. And, you know, I doubt if Trump, if it wasn't for COVID, I don't think Trump would have lost probably in 2020. You know, Biden got to run that basement campaign. So, you know, Democrats can fall all over themselves trying to reinvent themselves and adjust their policies. And I think to a certain degree, some of it is healthy. I think they got too woke and all that. But really, it's probably just, you know, if the Democrats, if it's The Rock versus J.D. Vance, then The Rock probably has a good chance of winning, you know?
Well, I think it's a little, I think it's a little too pat. I don't think it just means any old, any charismatic person can win, or it's just really, if you, it's a quantifiable thing. If you have more charisma, this person has 9 points of charisma, this person has 6 points of charisma on our D&D dies, then that person's going to win.
Well, it's more than that. You have to be tall as well. But yeah.
Trump had a persona built over decades, which to you and I is fraudulent nonsense, but to others, he is a successful businessman.
I know.
He's someone who knows how to make the economy work. And even if he's never won 50% of the vote, it's not like everybody believed it, but clearly some people did. And when that did not make everyone's life fantastic in 2020, that was not enough to win re-election. But because you could argue it was some sort of weird anomaly and the problem before us being inflation can be fixed by this person who knows how to make money and make us all wealthy, then I can go back and feel like the kind of persona and charisma this person has offered fits the time. I remember when I was living in New York City in the aftermath of 9/11, when at first people thought we can't survive unless Rudy Giuliani stays in office. He provides a certain leadership that only he could do. And there was even this brief moment we talked about suspending the election because we couldn't, how would we get by without Rudy Giuliani in that position? And once that was set aside, and the race was between Michael Bloomberg and Mark Green. And Mark Green was a longtime Democratic politician, traditional kind of politician. Mike Bloomberg, billionaire businessman, never been in public office before. And there was just this massive propaganda campaign that he is the right man, that you need a billionaire businessman to deal with the aftermath of 9/11, which obviously makes no sense at all. There is no connection between making a lot of money in the media business and governing a city in the aftermath of a terrorist attack. But I mean, backed by just a completely oppressive, you know, ad campaign. You know, Jimmy, Mark Green was just drowned in money. And you know, Mike Bloomberg, not Mr. Charisma, mind you. He's not Donald Trump in that respect, but they did infuse him with this sense of uber competence. And with the mismatch of money that worked. I mean, there's plenty of self-made businessmen who don't win elections. I don't want to, I would not argue that the businessman wins every time because they don't. But there is a way to make those stars align depending on the particular circumstances of that election. And we're not going to have that circumstance in 2028 because Donald Trump's not going to run again. I don't care about your conspiracy theories. Right. He's not going to be on the ballot in 2028.
But to the larger point is, I think people in the media, certainly people who are political operatives, we want to focus on the things we can control. And we can control press releases. We can control, you know, to a certain degree, fundraising. We can control the get out the vote operation. We, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we can control. And we want to believe that that is important. But actually, it's mostly about the candidate, who the candidates are. To a degree that I think we're not terribly comfortable with, but that's really a lot of what the ballgame is.
Now, I don't know if you saw, Matt, I did my annual year-end Politico assessment of which presidential candidates in the future, in this case 2028, which of them won 2024, which is obviously, I'll say this openly, you know, an inherently kind of hackish exercise. It's for entertainment purposes only. I try to do it with a substantive injection of substance. But you know, it's the kind of thing where people can debate all day long, you know, who's right and who's wrong. No, I don't know if you had a chance to read that and had any thoughts from it.
Well, no, correct me if I'm wrong. You normally do kind of like a listicle where you rank them. And this time I felt like it was more organic, where you're reading through and you'll see a bolded name like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But it wasn't as linear as it has been in the past.
I've structured it slightly differently depending on the year, just what, you know, what I felt the data in front of me, you know, how best to kind of put it together. In this case, I kind of put it in kind of brackets, like who's the winner of Democratic senators, who's the winner of Republican administration officials, and then there were kind of like implied losers, you know, within those sections.
I felt like it flowed well.
Thank you.
Here's something that I believe that may be a little controversial, but I think it's true. You know, someone like an AOC right now, I don't think Democrats will nominate a woman again anytime soon.
It's not going to be a barrier. It will be discussed. I mean, this happened in 2008, where there's a lot of like, I don't know if we can get a black person to win or if a woman can win. You know, we just lost George Bush. And so, I mean, that was kind of the undercurrent to John Edwards that maybe he was the right guy for the time. And this is somewhat illogical, but because Obama won Iowa, because he won a bunch of white liberals in Iowa, there was a sense that, oh, well, maybe he can win white votes. And that brought...
But the problem is, in the case of Obama, okay, the Obama analogy would work better if, like, Jesse Jackson had been the nominee and lost in, you know, 2004. And if, you know, I don't know who had been the nominee and lost. Like, there's no pattern of Democrats actually nominating an African-American and watching him lose. There is now a pattern of Democrats nominating female candidates and losing.
Yeah. Look, Democrats are pretty scarred. There's definitely a lot of political PTSD now with the Democratic Party, and there's going to be a nervousness about it. And the question is going to have to be, can, if you are a woman running, it's a 1,000,000,000% unfair. But you know, a double standard was put on Kamala Harris, and you can't necessarily remove the double standards from people's psyches. Show me you can overcome the double standard. Show me that you've sort of picked the lock. Now I said in the article, I think Kamala Harris is retaining a reservoir of goodwill, not from every Democrat, but from a lot of Democrats. And depending on how she carries herself in the next couple of years, could very well be the candidate to beat. And that's not always the case. You know, Democrats often tend to kick their losers to the curb. But she did win that debate. There's little dispute about that. Her gaffes were minimal, and what little you can point to, you know, how she answered the question on The View about separating from Biden. That's not going to be the kind of question she gets asked, you know, if she ran again. That was sort of a unique circumstance. You know, she was a very disciplined campaigner. You might say too disciplined. Maybe that can be a critique that you have of her. But I don't think she walks away shouldering the lion's share of the blame. Most people are blaming Biden for hanging around too long, or blaming inflation for not being properly dealt with or communicated about. And if Trump is a disaster and Kamala is there, you know, playing the I told you so game, look, just the way Trump did in the last 4 years, her stock could rise. And so, again, polling is going to matter here. I mean, if you see Kamala doing that sort of thing and they're doing like Harris-Vance trial heats and she is winning them, that's going to start building up some confidence that perhaps she has figured it out. But, of course, that's a lot to get us from point A to point B.
I don't want to go into the polling thing because the Ann Seltzer thing is still smart.
It does hurt, but on the whole, the polling wasn't wrong. The polling showed a very close race. So what it missed is that there was a fairly uniform break towards Trump in the swing states, but not, you know, outside the margin of error. So it's not, I don't think you can say the polling industry had a fail here. It was a close race. We always said this could break one way or the other with a percentage point or two. And that's what happened.
Yeah, you're right. We did say that. I'm intrigued by the Kamala thing. Like, on one hand, I agree with everything you said, and Nixon did it, right? Nixon came back. Maybe she can do it. And then also, as you noted, she's not going to be running against Trump next time. And so the whole dynamic's different. I think Trump against a woman is not good for the woman, usually. I think we've learned that. And Trump is sort of uniquely popular in a weird, cultish sort of way that we don't fully appreciate. You and I don't fully understand, but we do acknowledge it. So that's the argument for Kamala. I just wonder how much Democrats are now chastened, and especially in a way, the fact that they believed in Kamala and then had the rug pulled out from under them kind of makes it scarier to trust her again in a weird sort of way.
Like, I think this, it's gonna, as much as people can be poll skeptics, and there probably be people who won't want to believe it. But if Harris is winning trial heats against, you know, whether it's J.D. Vance or it's Trump Jr. or whoever is considered the most likely, you know, nominee, I mean, there's going to be a lot of default presumption of Vance unless Trump does something to, you know, in what's often the case in the world, you know, Trump House intrigue, people can be lifted up or taken down a peg by a Truth Social post. So for some reason, Vance gets on Trump's bad side, the way, I don't expect a Mike Pence type situation, but Trump can be very, very fleeting with his praise and with his criticism. But there'll be a default assumption of Vance pending other information. We'll see that trial heat polling a lot, I think, you know, in a year or so. And if Harris does well in that polling, she's going to have a base of support at minimum.
All right. Well, I know you have a heart out, but this was good to just get back in the mix. It was nice getting back in the warm waters of DMZ and feeling things out.
What do you got to plug?
read me at the Hill, please. I'm writing once a week there, a column, and it's just so nice to just write once a week, and I feel like every week it seems like the columns are relevant. I mean, this week's was about Mike Johnson. Last week's was about, it's just the biggest thing happening that week I usually try to write about. Last week's was about Elon and Vivek versus Loomer and Steve Bannon. So enjoying that thoroughly, Bill. I'm working on my Travis picking skills in between, you know. Tough.
I'm still plugging away at the banjo. I got a long way to go. So I wrote that Politico piece that you might want to check out recently at the Washington Monthly. I looked at the Nippon Steel deal, which I thought Biden should approve. After I wrote that, Biden did not approve it, which I think was the wrong call. And I also looked back again, and I wrote about this before the campaign, Trump's obsession with trying to convince us that everything was great in the Gilded Age when in the era of high tariffs.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I'm a history guy, Matt. The notion that Trump is going to be rewriting our understanding of history, I find very, very unnerving. But he's really committed to this bit that we were so wealthy in the Gilded Age, and the shift from tariffs to income tax as a source of funding for the federal government is what ruined us. Which is just completely ahistorical. So I revisited that again in terms of this nationalistic opposition to the Nippon Steel deal, which I think is just going to deprive Pennsylvania steelworkers of billions in investment. So I think it's a complicated story. I think on the merits, the deal deserved approval, but here we are.
All right. Good show. Great to be back with you. We'll see you next time in the DMZ. Bill.
Take care.